Welcome everyone to Sutta class for today. And so for today, as I mentioned before, we'll be looking at the presentation that I gave yesterday, which was prepared for the ABCAP, Australian Association of Buddhist Counselors and Psychotherapists. And just by way of a bit of introduction, the reason why I wanted to do this presentation and put it together was because in the ABCAP course and various presentations and so on, there have been some discussions and so on based on dependent origination and using it in various kinds of contexts. And I found those contexts are very interesting because they were using dependent origination in ways that I hadn't thought of, in ways that probably not strictly, you know, contexts are not strictly found in the suttas and so on. So it's a very sort of creative application of it, but one which obviously was quite practical and quite effective. For example, looking at how sort of bearing it as a model in terms of say addiction and treating of people with addiction problems was one context in which it had been brought up. So one of the things that I felt during these kinds of discussions was that the way that dependent origination was understood and the way it was presented and so on was quite heavily conditioned, naturally enough, by the forms that Buddhism has been taken and presented in the West and in modern times. And From my perspective, for someone who focuses primarily on the understanding of early Buddhism, not the way the Buddhism is being transmitted through the schools, it seemed to me that these teachings were in some ways impoverished, that they didn't present the breadth of variety and the complexity of the teachings on conditionality and dependent origination, which we find in the suttas. So what's tended to happen is that in the suttas you find a whole range of different teachings on conditionality in all different kinds of contexts. The later traditions, however, tended to pretty much ignore most of those contexts and just focus on the 12 links, which of course is the central teaching on dependent origination, so that when we refer to dependent origination, in fact, we're referring to the very famous list of 12 links rather than to the broader spectrum of the teachings on conditionality found in the suttas, which cover all kinds of other contexts, which may be, fair enough, may be relatively minor compared with the main teaching on the 12 links, but nevertheless, they do have something to offer. So I thought it would be useful to go back to some of those other teachings which are placed in the suttas in some kind of relationship with the 12 links of dependent origination, and to see what they said about various kinds of questions and uses to which dependent origination and the teaching of conditionality can be and often is applied in modern times. Now, there are many context which could be relevant here. For example, dependent origination is commonly used in the context of the environment and the idea of interdependence and so on, and we certainly find teachings along those lines in the suttas, and there are many other contexts which I could have chosen, but just for the purpose of this particular presentation, I just chose four areas which we'll look at briefly, one being the developmental psychology and the cognitive psychology, meditative psychology, and finally social psychology. And so just looking at one passage from the suttas or one teaching from the suttas on each of those topics. But before we get on to that, just have a look at the here's the basic 12 links, and as you can see, the nice bright colours are put in there for decoration. They're not really decoration. It's a code. Who knows how to crack the code? This will tell you. Who wasn't there last night?
Brown on the signature.
brown ones.
Well, it's red, but it looks brown.
Yeah.
Is it red?
I think it's supposed to be red, yeah, but yeah, I concur that it does brown.
Clay and grassy. Blue, is it something that you have some sort of, you might have some sort of control over? It's areas that you can actually.
Yeah, to some degree. It's not quite precisely yet, though. Yeah. Sorry? Foot? What's fruits? What? Apples? Sorry, no.
The fruits of the red ones. The blue ones.
The red ones are the fruit?
Of the blue ones.
Right. So these red guys. What they call, the technical term is the vipaka waka, the round of actually vipaka result, yeah? And so that's these are the things which more or less happen to you in your life as a result of other stuff, right? The active side of things. And so the active side of things has two parts. One is in blue, and this is usually called the kilesa vata, the round of defilements, ignorance, craving, grasping, all being sort of the motivations for action, the underlying forces. Yeah? The most basic of which, of course, is ignorance, and more developed or more formed aspects of which are the craving and grasping. And then finally, the acts of will or karma is the actual doing of things. The sankhara, actual going out and on the basis of that motivation, is actually accomplishing things, doing things. And you notice that here, that existence, bhava, has all three colours. Yeah, because of course bhava is encompasses all three aspects. Yeah, existence is everything. The whole, in fact, the whole of dependent origination. Often it's called the Bhava Chakra, the round of existence, so it really encompasses everything. And in the Bhava Sutta, in the Anguttara Nikaya 3, talks about that explicitly as Bhava encompassing these three different aspects. In fact, I think that's where these teaching on these three aspects comes from. So this is a conventional, this analysis of these factors is part of the traditional analysis of dependent origination, which is found not only in the Pali commentaries but also in the analysis in the northern schools as well. The other.
Before you
go on, yeah, please.
The blue ones, can you just clarify that again?
Okay, the blue ones. Yeah, the blue ones again are the what they call the kilesa vata, the round of defilements. So these are all different words for the defilements as the motivating forces which underlie the choices, which are sankhara. Yeah?
Yes, that is also where meditation comes in, to break the chain.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. That's right. And so remember, of course, this being the exposition of the arising of suffering, and the meditation coming in the exposition of unbreaking it, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, usually they're classified here. No, that's a good point that there are. It's kind of a mixture, yeah? I mean,
yeah.
Like physical pain is.
Actually,
yeah, physical pain you obviously do, but some of the others you don't. So, yeah, that's fair enough. That's a good point. So, now of course, the traditional way of looking at dependent origination, which I believe is also the way that it's found in the suttas, is in terms of three lifetimes, ignorance and sankharas, created acts in one lifetime, leading on to appearance of consciousness, rebirth of consciousness together with name and form. I'll come back to that in a minute. In the next life, the development of the embryo, the child, who gradually develops six senses, experiences contact through which they feel, they respond to the feeling with craving and grasping, and then leading on to again rebirth in a subsequent life. So the gaps here are the gaps from one life to the next, which is merely to indicate the process from one life to the next is not meant to take a stand on the question of whether there's an actual space in between one lifetime and the next, although I think there is, but that's just to illustrate that. And so this is kind of the gap, so this is kind of broken, part of it is like a broken nature of it, but also I've tried to phrase it, when I wrote it up there, it's a bit kind of clumsy and stuff, but you get the idea. I tried to phrase it all in one sentence, because it's all kind of one, like one breathless rush from one to the end. It's not actually broken up, it's actually all part of one syntax, which is all relating to, each part is relating to each other.
Yesterday you mentioned that there is a sort of enlarged version of this, because it would include the causes of ignorance, the five hindrances.
That's right, yeah.
Can you say something about that, or maybe later?
Yeah, that's a good point, that ignorance is not a first cause. Okay, so ignorance is not sort of some kind of fundamental entity that lies at the bottom of the universe or whatever, but ignorance is also part of the process, and ignorance itself is conditioned. And the Buddha said ignorance is conditioned by the five hindrances. Yeah? And so again, you can when they say ignorance is conditioned by the five hindrances, is exactly the inverse statement of saying that wisdom arises through samadhi. Yeah? Because the five hindrances are the opposite of samadhi, and so the five hindrances give rise to wisdom. Yeah? So if you say, samadhi gives rise to wisdom. Sorry about that, I was just testing. samadhi gives rise to wisdom. And the opposite of that, like the inverse of the statement, is to say that the five hindrances give rise to ignorance. And then from the five hindrances, he then traces it back in another series of factors, of all the different factors that give rise to the five hindrances.
But is it all wrong to say that wisdom gives rise to samadhi? If you didn't have that much wisdom, you wouldn't actually sit down and concentrate.
Very true, yeah. So these factors are not meant to be strictly linear in that sense, they're not strictly linear, but there's a linear aspect to it, a kind of a linear kind of dimension to it, and in some sense, even though it certainly is the case that wisdom conditions samadhi, and that's talked about often in the suttas, but at the deepest level, there's also a sense in which it really is a kind of one-way movement, not in the sense of any kind of wisdom, but in the sense of specifically of liberating wisdom, really kind of profound wisdom, has to arrive with samadhi itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this is referring to the wisdom that belongs to not the seeking wisdom, but just holding wisdom.
That gives rise to samadhi, you mean? Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then sort of like the six senses.
Yep.
The realms where you have less than six senses, and then the Navarupa, there's realms which are in there out of
that. Uh-huh, yep.
So maybe this only applies to certain realms, not all?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think it's perhaps stretching it a little bit further than is intended. One can interpret it as nevertheless applying in those cases, because even if the for example in the formless realms, even though there's no rupa in the formless realms, but still rebirth in the formless realms depends on developing rupa jhanas, yeah. Which themselves depend on actually meditating, which depends on having a body. So even the arupa realm is dependent on prior rupa, even though it's not dependent on rupa actually at the time. And the same thing you might develop a similar argument in the case of realms that were lacking in certain faculties. But look, I would agree, you know, nevertheless, I mean, that's getting a bit technical. I think generally speaking, yes, it's meant to apply, you know, to this realm and to realms which are relatively similar to this realm, you know. That's where it's obviously targeted. Right. That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's still dependent.
with those refined consciousness, one of the six senses concept,
yeah.
It seems to me, and from reading many different subjects people describe them in different ways, and they're sort of, they're starting to be linear, like there's like a network, even the way contact is described.
Mm-hmm.
It involves consciousness.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's like, I mean, I've tried to draw it as a diagram,
mm-hmm.
and it's basically it's an interconnection.
It is, yeah.
And it seems to exist, well, it exists, especially in time. This thing happening at the same time.
Yeah.
Definition of context depends on, and it doesn't depend linearly, it depends on the existence at that time of two or three other things.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
So it's not linear in that respect.
At that point, yeah. See, that's quite correct. You know, the definition of contact is tinglan sankati paso, is the coming together of the three things, the internal, the external, and the consciousness, is contact. So, and that's a structural conditionality. Those things are all present at one time. It's describing a structure of one event of experience. The important thing with dependent origination is that in defining the relationship of dependence, what is expressed in that by saying dependent on ignorance there are sankharas, dependent on sankharas is consciousness and so on. What's implied in that relationship is the minimal merest statement that these things are dependent on one another. It's not saying anything particular about the nature of that kind of dependency. Yeah? And so within that structure of the 12 links, you actually find various kinds of dependency, some of which are obviously linear, such as birth, ageing and death, and others of which are not, such as you just said is a structural one, and another famous example is the relationship between vijnana and nama-rupa, which is obviously another clearly non-linear relationship. And in other cases, one might suspect that there is partly linear and partly non-linear relationship, as I'll go to talk about in a minute, the relationship between craving and grasping, I think, is of that kind.
Also, consciousness, because I've been going through is like trying to, looking at the definitions, things like consciousness and sixth sense spaces. And I mean, consciousness is always seems to be described in terms of consciousness, eye consciousness, and
consciousness,
etc. Yeah. It sort of seems to be, you can't describe senses without
The definition in terms of the six senses is actually a reductive definition whose purpose is to eliminate the Upanishadic notion of consciousness as a self-existent thing, yeah, which is a kind of a metaphysical permanent entity. So instead you analyse it through experience and say actually when we observe consciousness all we can see is this arising and passing of the different sense experience. Exactly, yeah.
Would have split of consciousness really into subconscious and unconscious reactions or motivations if you want to be very precise?
Yeah. That's another kind of thorny question. In the use of the word consciousness here, and generally in Buddhism, means kind of mere awareness, okay? And as such, it's not exactly the same as how it's used in psychology. So the question of the relationship between the terms in Buddhist psychology and then Western notions like the conscious and unconscious mind is then a kind of, it's an open field, but that's like a matter of creative interpretation. It can be viewed in a number of different ways. But what one thing that's interesting in there is, I just noticed the other day, is that in the Bhava Sutta I mentioned earlier, the Buddha described consciousness as a seed, vijñānaṁ bījaṁ. And consciousness as a seed was taken up as an image in the later Yogacara teaching, where the storehouse consciousness, alaya vijñāna, was described as being the possessor of all the seeds. And this became a very important image for the nature of consciousness. And so that idea of the seeds is essentially similar to the way that a seed works in plants, is that you have a seed which stores the information in terms of DNA, which enables the plant to reproduce itself from one existence to the next. So that's the sense in which the consciousness is a seed. It stores up the information for the next life. But it's interesting because I was reading Jung talking about the unconscious, and he used exactly the same phrase, and he said that the unconscious is like a storehouse for all the seeds. Yeah.
Is that,
It's very, very similar in meaning, yeah. Okay, dependent origination as an origin myth. That's another aspect which I could have taken up and had a look at. The suttas don't present it in that way. You know, the suttas present dependent origination as a rational teaching, which obviously it is, not rather than a mythic one, and it's a rational and analytical teaching. But nevertheless, there are very important parallels and patterns of similarity between dependent origination and origin myths. And personally, I think that, and you can also see, even in the Rig Veda, you can see a tendency where the origin myths start to be rationalised. That's in the Rig Veda, you can see that. You can also see it in other contexts, such as the Memphis theology in ancient Egypt. But so the suttas don't make that. I think the suttas are probably more concerned to differentiate themselves from seeing it as mythology. They're concerned to sort of to show that it's not just a mythology. Yeah, it was a mythology. Whereas in fact, I think there are important parallels. Okay, so the first context we're going to look at is developmental psychology, and I'm taking as the example here the Mahāpāṇaha-saṅkhaya Sutta from the Madhyama Nikaya, which is a sutta that probably deals with dependent origination at the greatest length in the Majjhima Nikaya. And that talks about, here in the context of dependent origination, has this passage. This is an abbreviation of the passage just to fit on here. But when there is conception in the womb, the mother protects the embryo for 9 or 10 months with great anxiety and trouble, and then gives birth. She nurtures the baby with her own blood, and the text says, because a mother's milk is known as blood in the noble discipline. As the boy grows, his faculties mature and he plays games such as taking a bowl, turning somersaults, making toy windmills with palm leaves, or making small carts and bows. As his faculties develop further, he is provided with the five types of sense pleasure. Seeing a form with the eye, he becomes greedy for a pleasant form or averse to a disagreeable form. He abides with mindfulness of the body not established and with a limited mind, not knowing release. Delighted with those feelings, he grasps them. Then there's existence, birth, from birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. Thus arises this whole mass of suffering. So, again, it's a slightly abbreviated version of the passage, but so this is one of the passages in the suttas that very clearly presents dependent origination in terms of physical development during life, rather than purely as a psychological process. And of course, the conception process and the acknowledgement of the mother's role, and especially her suffering and the trouble and efforts that she has to go to give birth, is quite important in this context. When it says that mother's milk is blood, then this is referring to quite a literal interpretation, which is very common in ancient times, which says that milk is a purified form of blood, and this is quite explicitly believed in both West and in the East as well, that mother's milk is a purified form of blood. And of course, the other interesting thing I like about here is the games which he's playing, and we've discussed previously in the Digha Nikaya, the kind of list of various kinds of toys and games and things like that, and boys are still playing with small carts and bows, and they're still turning somersaults, and most kids these days wouldn't be clever enough to make a toy windmill out of palm leaves, but I'm sure if they could, they'd probably like it. So, very similar kind of games, aren't they?
Just talking about boys, not the girls.
Oh.
I don't expect that they talk about the child.
The child. Yeah. Look, I can't even remember. I have to look at the actual text itself. Usually, the text by default is male, usually Pali. Yeah. It's like in English where you just say, you know, a man does this or something, and it's the kind of default gender. But I would have to check the text itself to see whether that's the case here, or it might be just an artifact of the translation. Yeah.
So if one presents this dependent origination and takes the sutta to explain it from a different angle, from a different perspective, wouldn't it be nice to make it neutral?
Of course, yeah. Yeah? Can do.
Or at least say, boy, say this. I don't know what girl.
Of course you can do that, yeah. Of course you can do that, yeah. And the only reason I kept it as a boy here, because it made the text a little bit clearer, because the mother's referred to as her.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you keep the boy referred to as here, it makes it a little bit clearer.
It's just a suggestion,
sure. Yeah. An important point here, a number of important points. One is that this is based on and is showing a very important emphasis on development, which might seem kind of obvious, but I don't think it's as obvious as it might seem. The point here is that when we develop and when we grow, do we simply have the same things and then get more of them, or do we actually develop different kinds of things as we grow older? Which what kind of thing is growth? Is growth simply an expansion, or is it actually developing different kinds of things? And if you come from something like a soul theory, okay, or an Atman theory, then in a sense you're committed to saying, well, basically, whoever you are there at the beginning, in some ways, complete. You're the whole thing, yeah, because that's your self is already reborn in that kind of way. Whereas what it's talking about here is a process where actually at the period of infancy and early childhood, one isn't yet complete, not yet fully developed as a person. And in particular, it's only later in life, and it's kind of indeterminate here, but probably We discussed this, probably talking about maybe at age 7 or 8 or something, when children are actually starting to be capable of knowing right from wrong and making ethical decisions and understanding these kinds of things and reflecting on them from that period for the next several years. One's developing that kind of moral sense. And so it's from that time that a person is able to actually do good or bad karma. They're actually able to make choices. So, of course, usually if you're an infant, then we don't assume that an infant is able to make moral choices at all. And even for much older children, if you break the law or something like that, if you're 15 or whatever, then, it's not considered to have the same severity as if you do it when you're 18 or 20 or something like that. So we have this understanding that our level of moral responsibility is in part dependent on our age and increases as we get older. So I think that this is related to, in dependent origination, the notion, just to come back to the basic 12 links here, of the link between craving and grasping. And this particular link is actually quite problematic because craving is tanha, grasping is upadana, and generally speaking they mean more or less the same thing. Okay, so they're generally used as synonyms. And yet here they're distinguished, one leads to another, which tends to suggest that grasping is a more developed form of craving, and in the Theravadan tradition typically more or less just says that. It says that grasping is a stronger form of craving, which doesn't really explain anything very much. And it's interesting enough that in the Dalai Lama's exposition on dependent origination, he discussed the same interpretive problem. Okay, so even within the Tibetan interpretation is so similar to the Pali that we even have the same problems interpreting it, which shows how similar it is in detail. Because in fact, I think the answer here, what's going on here, is that these are referring to two somewhat distinct kinds of things. Craving is always defined in the suttas, or usually defined in the suttas, as craving for karma tanha, craving for sense pleasures, craving for bhava tanha is craving for existence, and vibhava tanha is craving for non-existence. So all of these are very fundamental drives, instinctual drives, which are present in any kind of being. Any kind of creature has a desire to live, any kind of creature possibly has this kind of desire for non-existence as well. And of course these relating to in modern psychology to the basic drives identified by Freud as being Eros and Thanatos, Eros being the sensual desire and desire to exist, and Thanatos being the desire to death wish and desire to not exist. So these are very fundamental, basic instincts, whereas grasping is defined as the fourfold grasping, grasping to sense experience, grasping to views, grasping to doctrines of a self, and grasping to sila bhata is usually translated as rites and rituals, but probably better translated as precepts and practices, or precepts and vows. And here I've just said in general behaviours. So obviously when we're talking about doctrines of a self, or certain kind of conscious behaviour, so sila bhata is not just an instinctual behaviour, it's not just something, it's not just walking or something like that, but it's an actually consciously done spiritual practice which you do as an external behaviour which you believe is going to change your mind or change your spiritual state of being. So obviously these are quite sophisticated things, right? You know, an animal, a dog has sensual craving and a dog has a will to live and so on. Whether a dog has a death wish or not, I'm not quite sure. Certainly some of the wombats around here have a death wish. But they certainly don't have doctrines of a self, right? As far as I'm aware. And they certainly don't have sila bhata. They don't take up vows and think, okay, I'm going to keep the 5 precepts on every upasana today so that I can escape my rebirth as a dog. Yeah? So it seems to me that this is what this is talking is, this developmental process from the instinctual and basic desires which an infant would have, or which any animal would have, leading on to the grasping is the more articulated and sophisticated, and in some sense more intellectual kinds of defilements and so on. And the interesting implication of that then, that has a number of interesting implications. One interesting implication is that it would explain why it's generally understood that, say, animals don't make very much kama. Okay? I'm not saying that they can't make any kama at all, but generally speaking, it's understood that animals aren't making the same kind of kama in the same strong way that human beings are. Right? If an animal is hunting another animal for its food, we don't see it as being morally blameworthy in the same sense that we do if a human kills another human or something like that. So this would explain that, but also it has another implication, which is that if we come to other versions of this pen origination, which we'll see a bit later, you see that the 12 links which are given here, giving up to the origin of suffering and so on, actually themselves becomes turned over and becomes part of the way leading to liberation as well. Yeah? So the developmental process doesn't stop with upadana, yeah, with the formation or attachment to a sense of self, but then it continues through the development of the Buddhist path, and of course then ultimately undoes the whole idea of self and so on and so forth. So what that suggests is that we can see these things as being part of a developmental process, so that the formation of an idea of self, and a formation of these normal kind of mental constructs, views and so on, is actually an essential prerequisite for the path of liberation. And so the problem in that case would be not the thing itself, the problem is getting stuck on the thing, which is of course where most of us end up.
I was just wondering whether grasping is also applicable to one's hanging on to things possessed by a person. But it has nothing to do with sense experience, but normally a person, when we're talking about an animal like a dog or something like that, I was thinking a dog holding on to their bones and having it's just like grasping.
Yeah. It is, that would be similar, but again, it's only partial. It's not the whole thing. But just one other point on that is I've used the notion of grasping. Usually, the notion is the translation here is clinging, but clinging I think is incorrect because clinging specifically means refusing to let go of something you already have, whereas what this is talking about is actually going out and grasping something. It's an active process which then stimulates the process of rebirth and so on. It's not merely the refusal to let go. It's the active going out and getting something.
I've forgotten actually, how is the chain broken? There's so many different
revelations. Well, again, because it's not a linear thing, that can be described in many different ways. Yeah, so obviously in some places it just talks about from the ending of ignorance and all of them break. In other ways it crosses over between feeling and craving. Then after you have a feeling, then you let go of the craving for it. So it reverses from there. And in the Mahatanha Sankhaya Sutta itself, it actually embodies that notion of the developmental process which I was talking about before. That you've gone through this whole thing and then thus arises this whole mass of suffering. But then somebody can go on to then hear the teaching of the Buddha, go forth, undertake the various practices of gradual training, and then leading to liberation. So, and in other ways it's taught differently. The Panisa Sutta we'll look at later, it actually comes after dukkha, after the ending of it. It then flips over. So again, that's just to re-emphasize that it's not a linear process. Yeah. Yeah.
Any difference between craving and attachment in English? And otherwise, the English word, personally.
Yeah, the English word, I think so, yeah. Craving is probably a bit strong for tanha. Craving Craving is a pretty strong word. Like if you're craving, it means I can't stop thinking about it, you know? Yeah, but in this case it means any kind of desire. It doesn't just mean really strong desire. Intellectual, yeah. What is interesting is that in psychology they use what they call attachment theory. And the idea of attachment theory is that at different stages in your development that you actually have to develop healthy attachments. And that if you don't develop those healthy attachments, then this will cause developmental problems. So for example, if you're rejected by your mother when you're born, then you won't develop your attachments to the mother and so you won't have a secure emotional development. Of course, at a later stage in your development, then you, of course, you have to let go of those attachments. Yeah? So that's, again, something which I think is perhaps related to this idea that I'm talking about here, that actually these things, although for adults, in a sense, they're an obstacle, but as in part of the developmental process, they actually need to be there in order to be able to progress further. There are quite a lot of other contexts in the suttas that talk about development give some insight into this. I won't go into all of them, but I think just from this is just my main purpose here is just to show that this developmental process is actually there. It is actually acknowledged, and it is actually part of that understanding of dependent origination. And so if we want to really know what this is about, we have to take that into consideration. But I'll leave it there, and I'll move on to the next passage, which is the Madhupindika Sutta. And this is perhaps a little bit more familiar in the modern context of dependent origination, and this is talking about the cognitive psychology of dependent origination. Now, of course, this passage, as with so many interesting passages in the suttas, is largely neglected by the tradition, but this one was rescued by Venerable Nyanananda, Sri Lankan monk, in the early 70s, who wrote a book, Concept and Reality, in which his analysis of this passage was very central. And it's from Nyanananda's work that we get the notion of vipancha as proliferation. Now, one of the fascinating things about this particular passage is that the psychological process which is being described here is mirrored in the syntax and the grammatical form of the sentence, yeah, which is quite astonishing. And so it manages to compact a lot of meaning within a very brief amount of time. And I've tried to mirror that by using fonts here. So you notice we have three different fonts, and each one is represents a different aspect of the psychological process. And the first one, dependent on eye and forms, eye consciousness arises, the meeting of the three is contact. With contact is condition is feeling. Now this is the process which Ayanale was referring to earlier, where there's this structural dependence of contact as the coming together of the three things. Now in this part of the process, the conditional relation is entirely automatic. Okay, it just happens. It's like a block of dominoes falling over, or just like it's just there. And that's what it feels like, isn't it? When you look at something, you open your eyes and you look, and it's just there. You're not, once you've looked, that you're not involved in that process. Of course, you are involved prior, because you needed to pay attention to actually look at that place, right? So we can look in other contexts and you see that actually depending on your interest and your attention will actually direct where you're going to look, right? But once you've actually looked there, from this point where it starts, it's just automatic, and the contact happens, and then there's some kind of feeling. So I've represented that with a font here, which is very blocky. So it's just like kind of blocks and squares. It's a static thing. It's an automatic process. And then from feeling, what one, it then goes from what one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, one thinks about. What one thinks about, one proliferates. So here we've got a different syntax and a different mood. Now what happens here is that, whereas before we had feeling as a noun, vedana, here we have feeling as a verb, vedeti. So that it's becoming an active process, yeah? It's not so automatic, it's starting to run along, it's starting to be more moving and more dynamic. And so I represented that here by using a font in italics, and particularly I used a font called Bodoni, which has a vertical uprights. It has the thicks and thins in it. It's a famous font, the thicks and thins are vertical. And so this is giving an idea that the vertical process in the first part is now tilted over, and it's starting to move along. And so these verbal forms are showing that the things, the entities, the nouns, which we've described in the beginning, are actually processes. We're actually moving into this processual situation. And also notice another very lovely detail about this is that in Pali, you don't have to state the subject of a verb. Right? So I put that here in brackets. What one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, one thinks about. What one thinks about, one proliferates. And the Pali doesn't have that. So the Pali just says, yang vedeti tang sanjanati, yang sanjanati tang vitakheti, yang vitakheti tang papancheti. So to make sense in English, we have to put the subject, but the Pali is not actually assuming that there's a subject. What feels, that perceives. What perceives, that thinks, what thinks, that proliferates. Yeah. So there's no subject stated, but the subject's kind of implied. There's a kind of subtle thought that maybe there's an implication of an underlying subject here emerging from this automatic process. And then by the third stage, that subject has become fully realized. Yeah, and we have the person here who is now fully manifested in consciousness. Based on what one proliferates, perceptions and reckonings of proliferation assail a person. Right? So there's no longer a kind of an automatic process. There's not like even a stream of processes, but now there's something which is actually overwhelming the person. One is being swamped, right, by these perceptions and reckonings of proliferation, which I'll come back to in a minute. But the idea that a person is swamped by these things, and also the introduction at this point of the past, present and future forms cognizable by the eye. In other words, that up till now, it's just a basic sense process which is happening in the present moment. You just see something and it's just there. Whereas now there's the idea of a self is there, and that self is something that exists through time. And so the past, the present and the future is all coming together. So what is the key term here, of course, is papancha, and papancha having the meaning of to proliferate or spread out. And so this is the difference here is because vitakheti or vitaka usually in Pali has a meaning, has quite a directed meaning. So the word taka by itself means logic, right? So it's a kind of focused or directed thought that actually works something out. And vitaka, of course, we find in, say, the jhana formula. So it clearly means a kind of it's something which is a directed and relatively focused form of thought. Whereas papancheti is the opposite, yeah? We've lost control of the thought and the mind sort of spinning out of control. And then these perceptions and reckonings of proliferation, no longer like is it sort of a feeling of us doing it, but in a sense we're feeling quite separate. Like I feel like I'm here and I'm and these thoughts and so on are just overwhelmingly they're like a tide which is washing over. Yeah, the sanya, the reckonings here is a sankhara, literal meaning reckoning, meaning in some sense the way that we measure and evaluate things. Yeah. The sankhas, our concepts, evaluative concepts of things. And so this is where we've really lost control of the process, and we feel like we're a a helpless bystander, if you like, in our own mind, in our own psychological process. And I think this is where a lot of stress comes from, and a lot of feeling of that we can't control, because we feel like that, don't we? We feel like I can't control what my mind is doing. And a lot of people have obsessive thoughts. They can't stop thinking about something. You're controlled and dominated by your thoughts rather than using your thoughts to do something constructive. So this is, I think, the implications of this particular passage here. And as always, it not just explains the situation, but it also implies an approach to dealing with the problem. And that is that one can intervene during this middle part before the papancha really starts. You can, the stage of feeling or perception or even thinking, that you can recognize what's going on and use mindfulness and direct the mind in a different way. And different meditative practices do this in different ways. So, for example, in psychology you have cognitive behavioral therapy, or in Buddhism the practices which are described, say, in the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, where one's thinking in the wrong way, in an unwholesome or destructive way, and one can then replace those thoughts with more wholesome thoughts. And so that's intervening in the process at this stage. Or one could intervene even earlier, at the stage of perception, by say, developing the appropriate forms of perception. If you see something as permanent, then developing the perception of impermanence, and so on. Or one can intervene even earlier at the stage of feeling, and being mindful of one's feeling and not allowing the mind to spin off out of that. And so the idea with all of those processes is, don't let it become Comic Sans, which is the font that I'm using. The last part is Comic Sans, the world's third most hated font. Well, by the time you get down to the end here, of course, it's all happening in the mind.
Yes,
but this is
the
stimulus.
The thoughts start in the mind. If the first part, there is in that sutta, does it talk about mind consciousness? The mind objects?
And I should say that, as with all of these contexts, that actually the suttas themselves give a lot more, you know, a lot more richness and a lot more context. This is just one isolated passage.
So, I think we should speak more about the concept of the mano, vinyana, and citta. And how is you in this world?
Understand this.
You should speak more about the concept of mano and vinyana. In this context, I think the word vinyana. In the Pali?
Yes.
The Pali word vinyana.
Yeah.
Sometimes I use the word mano, and another time I use the word citta. The word citta is more in, and the process is more in with the vipaka.
Vipaka.
And the word mano is more in with the word of your vinyana, with the talk on your independent origination. So, if we don't have the basic concept of the Pali, it would
be
difficult to understand
grammar,
so
therefore
the past is
the
transfer of
past. Subtle. The
understanding is very easy.
Yeah, the Pali tends to be very precise in these psychological terms, yeah?
More precise, and
that's
the
past
definition here.
Very much so.
If you are the process, so in the commentary, it's called the Paramatma Dharma.
Yeah.
Another question.
Yeah.
The process.
Yeah.
And not talking about anyone, it's talking about what happened.
Yeah. And that's a very good point, Haya, is that it's an extremely objective description of consciousness, and you know, I think it's really unprecedented, certainly in the Indic tradition and anywhere else, to have that degree of clarity, you know, that the Buddha had, to actually just observe his own consciousness and see that this is what's happening. You know, and we all know from our meditation how very difficult it is to be able to step back and just watch and just see that these processes occurring.
Yeah.
Yep. Anyway, questions if you want.
Mano.
Uh-huh.
How do you spell it? M-A-N-O?
M-A-N-O. Yeah. Probably just something to take up as a maybe reading topic or something to look at in the future.
It's a special one, yeah.
Because you were showing an interest then.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So is it that you're saying mano and chitta and
vinyana
are sort of similar? But
they're that's right, they're sort of similar, but they're used in subtly different contexts. Yeah.
In
visual not quite, yeah. Some overlap, but also sometimes different. Yeah.
I'm going to feel it's very interesting when I change the body and
Yeah. That's right, yeah. And it's also interesting, that's one area where the Pali is much better than the Agamas, in the Chinese Agama, because you can't, the lens of the translation is too fuzzy. You can't get the details in the Chinese. Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to the next context, and this is the meditative psychology. Of course, there are many different passages and aspects that one could choose to look at meditative psychology in Buddhism, obviously the jhana formulas and many other things that are very interesting, but the one that I chose here in the context of dependent origination is called the Upanishad Sutta. Now, the Upanishad Sutta has a sequence of 12 factors which mirror the 12 factors of the ordinary dependent origination, except they show the way out of suffering rather than the arising of suffering. And in fact, this particular sequence, each factor is supposed to lead to the next, in the sutta is depicted as coming after the standard 12 links. So it starts out with ignorance, sankharas, consciousness, and so on, leading up to birth, aging, death, and the various forms of suffering, and then suffering giving rise to faith, gladness, rapture, and so on. So this is appended. It becomes a 24 links rather than 12 links. And similar processes are described constantly in the suttas in many different contexts. So the seven factors of awakening, the gradual training, all kinds of places we find a similar psychology of meditation leading to awakening. Now, one of the critical things here is that, which I really like, is that suffering leading to faith, which I think is very lovely, and it's always very reassuring, especially on those dark nights, especially on the dark nights of the soul. And you know that no matter how much suffering there is, Buddha has been there. And when you reflect that the Buddha's teaching is all about suffering, then you realize, well, actually, maybe there's some hope for me yet. Yeah? Maybe there's some hope. Because this is what the Buddha was talking about. So that's why I think this, I mean, this is kind of a bit beside the point, but I think that's why it's important to not neglect the subject of suffering. And sometimes I think modern Buddhism likes to talk too much about happiness. Which is all very well and good, but in a sense it can convey the impression that Buddhists are sort of somehow a bunch of happy people, and if you're a sad Buddhist, there's something wrong with you, which of course is not the case, you know? And so suffering giving rise to faith. Of course, suffering doesn't automatically give rise to faith. This isn't a process that one thing must inevitably lead to the next. Sometimes suffering gives rise to despair. Yeah? Sometimes suffering gives rise to just giving up. But if you're somebody who has enough wisdom, and if you're fortunate enough to encounter the Dhamma, you hear the Buddha's teachings, and then faith can arise. Yeah. You might not know exactly what it is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's that just a kind of spark. Like, say, you know, say when the Buddha saw the fourth of the four signs. You know, he sees that just like, oh, actually, you know, maybe there is a way. Maybe there's something that I can do. Yeah. So that kind of springs up. Faith gives rise to gladness, which is quite good. And I quite like the fact that gladness happens quite quickly after suffering. Yeah. Which is also very psychologically very acute, because if, you know, no matter how deeply you're suffering, if you have that genuine spark of faith that comes up, it can really make your mind very glad very quickly. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily, sometimes of course it takes years, but in some cases it doesn't have to. Just, oh, yes, that's it, and boom, you become so happy. Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, sure, yeah, it's a contrast, the relief from that despair, because that's where a lot of that suffering comes from, yeah, is from the sense that you can't do anything about it. I'm stuck here, and, you know.
So it's a contrast.
Yeah. Yeah, he likes to stir people up like that. Okay, so faith, gladness. And now this gladness here is in Pali is pamoja. And pamoja essentially means ordinary, everyday sense of gladness or joy. Okay? And so the difference between gladness and rapture, the next one, in a sense, is just a matter of degree. They're similar qualities, but rapture is more meaning of a particularly refined quality developed in meditation. Okay, it's not a black and white distinction, but just as generally speaking, gladness is ordinary everyday happiness. Rapture is more commonly used in a meditation context. It can happen outside of meditation, for sure. Yeah, but that kind of rapture is a preliminary form of rapture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the word yoni is better because it's
more
mental. It's not physical, but it's mental.
For which one? For
piti.
For piti, joy, you think?
For piti, the English word yoni is better than the word capture.
Could use either. The reason I like to use rapture is because rapture is used more in a spiritual sense. Yeah.
But it's not the emotion. But the pity is more emotion, not the sensation.
Yeah, but I don't. Anyway, either rapture or joy could be used. You never find a perfect rendering. I do believe that in the Western tradition, when you have the Western contemplative tradition, and they would describe what they call rapture, I think they're talking about the same thing. I think they're talking about piti. Rapture is also used in another sense, in the sense that the rapture for a lot of evangelicals means that literally at the end of the world, your body is going to be lifted up and taken up into heaven, right? This is that sense. But that's actually not too dissimilar from the meditation sense, because that's what rapture feels like, that you're actually sitting there and your body's being lifted up into heaven. So, again, it's a matter of preference, but that's why I like to use that, yeah. But certainly joy is fine for that as well.
You know, rapture, like Blake was mentioning, that you can actually have an outside meditation, that, you know, there's times when you just feel
passages or when you come into contact with some like precepts of others and then you just feel
absolutely
overwhelmed and
yeah.
your whole body just feels it and you just start to shed tears of joy.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that possible?
Absolutely.
Rapture?
Yeah, absolutely. Oops. And so rapture, then rapture leading to tranquility, and again this is part of the regular meditation process. Actually it's not necessarily linear here, strictly here, but generally rapture often leads to tranquility because when you have rapture in your body it like clears and the energy clears out the tensions and energies and so on in your body. Kind of the rapture sort of moves through your whole body and makes you very content. And so that tends to lead to tranquility. Tranquility leading to sukha. And here sukha, of course sukha just meaning pleasure in general, but in this particular context sukha has quite a refined meaning. It's a very kind of subtle bliss which is developed prior to samadhi. So I use the word bliss in this context. Samadhi, of course, meaning the four jhanas and the state of deep unification of mind, where all of the previous developed factors all come together, they're all unified and balanced, working together, working in harmony, and the mind's completely unified. Samadhi is then the condition for knowing and seeing reality, yatha bhuta jnana dasana, which is the very penetrative and deep insight that comes with the realization of the Four Noble Truths. What's the question?
The ages of five hindrances.
Yeah.
Where you can understand reality.
Uh huh.
If you so choose
to. Yeah, but the absence of the five hindrances is the inverse of samadhi. Yeah. Samadhi is that which gets rid of the five hindrances.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, when your five hindrances are gone, then you can, if you wish, not
that's right, yeah. Right, so that's right, yeah. Technically, it's not a sufficient condition, it's a conditionality. It's not that everyone who gets samadhi will do that, yeah. Again, the same with all of these, that one factor doesn't necessarily lead on to the next, but there's a tendency. And actually, the sutta, the Upanishad sutta itself, describes that with uses the simile of the rain falling on the mountaintops, and when the rain falls on the mountaintops it fills up the little ponds, they overflow and fill up the bigger ponds, and they fill up the creeks, and the creeks fill up the streams fill up the rivers. Mm-hmm. So it's not a bit like what's happening now, eh? It is what's happening now. You can't be like something that you are. You can't be a metaphor for something that you actually are. And then the rivers fill up the great oceans, yeah? So there's this kind of process. So knowing and seeing reality, then disenchantment, nibbida, viraga, dispassion, and vimutti, release, and then the ending of the asavas, which modern renderings of that, they often say afflictive emotions, asavas or defilements or whatever. Now this particular process refers to the very, very kind of advanced stages of developing insight. Technically, I think knowing and seeing reality actually refers to stream entry, and these other stages, more advanced stages of development. But one thing that's important to notice is that development of disenchantment and dispassion and so on are based on all of that previous development, yeah, and they're based on the existence of a very healthy, happy, emotionally balanced mind, yeah, and one doesn't go straight from suffering to disenchantment and dispassion, all right. This other stuff comes in between, yeah, and if we skip over that, then that's when you can, and actually this is quite common, you find in Buddhist teachings, and you know, I find it as a teacher quite commonly, especially with young people, is that they will be very conscious of dispassion, have quite a negative perception of the world, it's all suffering, Buddha told us to let go of all of these things and so on and so forth. And yet underlying that, there's not the wholesome and the healthy development of mind and the maturity of mind which actually can allow those insights to happen properly. And so it tends to go into a kind of nihilism or a negative or pessimistic attitude towards things. So this is why it's very important that those teachings can be based on that sense of that wholesome emotional sense. And that's something that really struck me when I was at Bodhnyana, and I learned that because obviously Ajahn Brahm, being somebody who's developed all of these, you know, faith and gladness and happiness and so on so strongly, and so that's why when he comes to talk about suffering, he's also very happy to talk about suffering in a very kind of strong way. A lot of teachers, you find, get a bit nervous when it talks about suffering. It doesn't really mean suffering. It means, anxiety, or it means stress, or it means something. Ajahn Brahm says, nah, it just means suffering. because he knows what the happiness is, yeah, so he's not afraid of it.
That's why he likes
funerals.
Can you go to the previous?
Sure.
The last tree, I don't think it's when I can reach the last tree.
The stream enterer is the one, Yathabhuta Jnanadasana is here, yeah. And then these are like developing through to the Arahant by the end.
It's interesting that even someone not going out for a path to get up to Samadhi,
right,
they get that far, even would still say selfie or something.
Right.
So it's simple to sit the point and go a long way without actually having a corner of the truth.
So I think, you know, the important thing here is just that take-home message is that the process of developing meditation, you know, to if we want to develop insight, is we have to have that very wholesome basis in the happiness and tranquility and so on.
Sure. I can remember
that
yourself. When you went to learn that, it looks like your mom was happy, mom.
That's right.
Happy,
yeah. That's right, yeah.
That also says people who are ancient. That's sort of a greater training, and we don't mention anything about known truths or self views and stuff until after some complete and sequence process.
That's the normal situation, is that all those higher teachings on not self and all of those things come right at the end, Okay, so moving on to the next one. This is a passage, it's an excerpt from Mahanidana Sutta, again a very long, complex sutta, talking about dependent origination in various aspects, one of which is talking about social implications of dependent origination, which comes back to the point that Ayopeka made earlier about our relationship to externals and the things that we possess. And this one actually is taught more or less as a side thing. You know, you have the 12 links of dependent origination going down here, and then it sort of loops out at the side and comes back in. So we're looking at the side loop here, being this particular sequence, which is talking about the social implications of dependent origination. So the breaking point here is feeling. The nexus, feeling, craving nexus, and so from feeling and craving it then goes on to seeking, which you could also translate as shopping. Isn't that very true? It's very true. We go into the shopping centre, you're just looking around trying, what do I want? You've got this underlying sense of need and you just go kind of looking, what can I get? And so then the next one is buying, acquisition. Absolutely, looking for it, And this one, evaluation, is a little bit I can't remember what the Pali is now. A little bit obscure, but the meaning here, I think, is that what it's talking about is where you assess something as yours. Where you come to think of it, this is my thing. So once you've bought it, you then say, you take it home, this is mine. That's right, yeah.
More.
Exactly. Something like that, yeah, yeah. It's not explained in the text, so it's not entirely clear. But I think that's what the idea is. You know, if you think about it just in that context, you know, you're craving, you go shopping, you buy something, and then you come back, and then you like it so much. Exactly, how much you think of it, yeah, and you put it on your shelf, or you put it on the wall, or you put it in your cupboard, and you come home and you say, oh, look what I got, and so on. It becomes part of how you define yourself. You know, I'm the person who has these nice clothes, or who has this good painting, or who has this food, or whatever. Yeah, yeah. Now, these next ones, desire and lust is chandaraga, attachment is prigaha or something? Anyway, I can't quite remember. These are more or less synonyms, and wouldn't make too much about the distinction between these things. Possessiveness, I think macharya, possessiveness, not macharya, stinginess, possessiveness. Anyway, the meaning is obviously to hold on to something. Stinginess is specifically the refusal to share, yeah, to you know, because this is mine and because I want it, then I'm not going to let others have it. Yeah, so it's that ungenerousness of heart. And then the later is, once you start thinking in that way, then you have the defensiveness. Araka is like guarding what you have. So you start to get paranoid about your things and to lock them up. And of course, this being a quality which has overtaken, it seems, our society to a quite astonishing degree. And it's interesting that doesn't apply in many places. If you look in many societies, and even in a lot of the ancient civilizations, they didn't have any locks on the doors or anything like that. You know, in the ancient cities and things like that, you know, things were just open. And people just didn't have that same kind of need for guarding their possessions, yeah, especially from each other. They might guard them from, say, people outside, yeah, so there might be walls around to stop bandits or something, but they didn't guard it from their neighbours in the same way that we do today.
It's also interesting, rural areas often help them to, you know, sometimes that's a lot more place of trust.
Right, yeah. That's right, yeah.
So I think when I was a kid, I
Yeah. It's definitely become much, much bigger tendency, yeah.
I think changing the way of order because of being rich and being for travel a lot of things, because rich people that still work, stronger than the poor people. And rich countries have even most high and most healthy war and defense.
Healthy war, you mean?
War, defense.
War.
G-U-R-D. What is it? Protective.
God.
Ward.
Ward. We are WARD.
Protection.
Okay.
Guard.
Guard.
Yeah.
American, you know,
more than anyone, I think.
Yeah.
Very strong, yeah.
Usually rich people, they
always
on
God,
yeah.
They
cannot be open.
Yes, they should go to the problem. Yeah. Because it's not so easy with wealthy. I mean, nowadays, I think people feel very insecure, and a lot of it's to do with just what they see in the media and the news, and like old people are constantly being told, about home invasions and all sorts of things, and in reality, there's very little difference between now and about 50 years ago, but people have this just their sense of fear from what they hear in the news and so on.
I remember when I was a child, you know, thinking everybody can come, we don't have to get out, we don't have hotel, and everybody can. going to attend it. Every how open the door for the person.
Mm.
But whenever I went to Shirdi, know how open to me and I just stand to that talk. And people are very much on one and very much professional.
Yeah.
And they are rich people. They have healthy people. But they cannot have that kind of trust and open it. There are poor people in the village.
Yeah.
Everywhere I learned that I should be here. People are here, we don't have any hair here.
Talking with my mum, because my mum had her, she had her house broken into, and it was, we were talking about that, and she's saying, well, it's one of the things that they have to do, because they have a maid or a cleaner who comes and cleans the things, and they have to make sure that everything's locked up, so that it's not a temptation for them, and it's out of compassion for them, it's so that they don't have that. So yeah. Okay, so the guarding and leads to various unskillful things, taking up of sticks and knives, conflicts, quarrels and disputes, accusations, divisive speech and lies. So, again, this is something that we see so strongly in our society, the presence of security forces, people with weapons and so on, who are there to guard property, in other words, to make sure that some people have their property and others can't get that property, and the taking up of wars to protect one's economic interests and so on and so forth, which Australia is participating in at the moment. And we had a lot of protests about the Iraq war in 2003 when it started, but after that, well, you're just going to get used to it, and it's nearly 10 years later and it's just part of the landscape and we don't think about it anymore. But actually that's what we're doing, is we're invading another country without provocation, without being threatened in any way by that country, and precisely for these reasons, to protect our own, what we see as our own possessions, which in fact is the possessions of another country. They might have pulled them out, but there's still an involvement in it. So, but the important thing about this one is that it's showing, because it comes out of the standard dependent origination, it's showing that this process actually has implications that are not just personal. Yeah? So obviously the primary link of the primary focus of the 12-fold link of dependent origination is to show in one's own personal spiritual development. Yeah, that's the main focus. But here it's showing that spiritual development actually is interconnected with the wider society, and that the choices that we make, the way that we use our mind and so on, is also leading to these phenomena which we see outside of ourselves. Yeah? And so these things are not disconnected. So I think this is very important as an example of how this happens. And as I mentioned briefly at the beginning, this is not just in the social sense, also environmental sense, and other cases are mentioned in the suttas where similar processes are showing as having an effect outside of oneself.
Avarice,
Is that in the Pali? What would be the Pali is macharya, isn't it? It's the same meaning? Stinginess and avarice, isn't it the same meaning?
I thought stinginess, avarice is like this between grass and green. I would have thought stingy is sort of holding it and not letting it go.
Uh-huh.
But avarice is going out and getting stuff.
Uh-huh.
Or being more proactive about
is it?
Is
it avarice?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, no,
that's more in the earlier stages, yeah. Yeah, so stinginess is more the, yeah, not
mind, you're trying to have it.
Yeah, not wanting someone else to get it.
Can you show the
Not easy, because the internet's not up and I don't have the Pali local. Oh, I might have the Pali locally.
We can
look it up later, yeah. It's macharya in that one, particular word. Okay, so come to the last one. This is James Joyce's take on dependent origination, which I just put there just for the hell of it. Yeah, this is a quotient from Finnegan's Wake, yeah. In the ignorance that implies impression, that knits knowledge, that finds the name form, that wets the wits, that convey contacts, that sweetens sensation, that drives desire, that adheres to attachment, that dogs death, that bitches birth, that entails the ensuance of existentiality. It just comes in the middle of a paragraph of other sentences which are far more obscure than this one. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Okay, so there's dependent origination in a few different contexts. So anyone got any more questions before we wrap up?
This is not so spiritual talk, but my question. With the, some of the sutras in the Samhita, when you go into Samhita, it says that Nama-rupa conditions consciousness and consciousness conditions Nama-rupa. Can you explain how that can
be? Of course. Right. That's a major theme in Mahanidana Sutta and other places.
Mm.
So the question is about.
I'll put the other thing too, looking at that, and it's probably. Is involved with these various sort of definitions of consciousness and how it's used in different ways and different places.
Mm.
It Nama-rupa seems to also incorporate other parts of the chain of conditionality, like feeling and context and all and perception.
Yeah.
So I think I don't really understand
Nama-rupa
properly. It seems to incorporate other things that appear in other places.
It does, yeah. No, you shouldn't worry about it, but you should inquire into it. I'm hesitating because I'm just wondering about how deeply to go into it.
I don't mind if you do it.
The easiest way to think of it, or the most straightforward way, is that consciousness is awareness and Nama-rupa is the objects of awareness.
Mm.
Okay? Now that's not entirely correct and it doesn't exhaust the thing, but that's part of it. So that's why they always come together. Now, the idea that they're mutually conditioning, the reason why that's emphasized in the suttas is because is as a direct critique of the Upanishadic idea. So the Upanishads say that Nama-rupa, that when Nama-rupa ends, that this what's left is the infinite consciousness. So they say there's an asymmetrical relationship between them, and the simile that they give is the simile of the rivers going down to the sea. It says, like, just like each river has its own name and its own shape, but when it reaches the great ocean, they're all just reckoned as one, as the great ocean. Yeah, they lose their name and their shape. So the idea of the Upanishads is that the Nama-rupa ends and that what's left is the ocean of infinite consciousness. Yeah. So the Buddha quite directly critiqued this, and this is clear from a number of contexts. So for example, the soul is a panha in the Sutta Nipata, where these these teachings are brought up by Brahmins who are specifically asking this, and the teachings discussed there. So what Nama Rupa is, in order to understand what Nama Rupa is, then you have to wade through or distinguish between a number of different layers of meaning of that term, which actually are quite distinct and have their own purpose, and which can be quite confusing if you're not clear about it. Okay, so the first rendering, most common rendering of Nama Rupa is mind and body, which you find is an Abhidhamma dependent rendering, which is just wrong in the context of the suttas. So it doesn't mean mind and body in that sense. It's not completely different from it, but it doesn't mean that. In the suttas itself, and in the context of dependent origination, it gives the definition which you were referring to, which analyzes rupa as the four great elements and derived materiality, and nama as being feeling, vedana, sanya, perception, cetana, intention, manasikara, attention, and pasa, contact. Okay, five dhammas. Now those five dhammas are regarded in the Abhidhamma as being mental qualities which are present at every moment of consciousness, or every event of consciousness, that's a better way of putting it. So in other words, these are the psychological factors, the functional factors that make consciousness work. They support consciousness and enable it to work and do its job. Yeah? So that's another reason. But that reading of the word nama, when you look at that, you see, well, what does nama mean? Nama means name, right? The basic meaning of nama is name, yeah? And so when nama means name, then that meaning is already quite detached from the meaning of nama as name, yeah? So that shows that it's already quite a developed, quite an evolved philosophical interpretation of nama, rather than being a root meaning of nama. Okay, so we're talking about a process here. The reason for that is because, like the treatment of vijnana, where I mentioned before that the analysis of vijnana as the sixth sense consciousness is intended as an analytical and reductive critique of the Upanishadic notion of consciousness as a universal consciousness. So in the same way that analytic treatment of nama is a critique of an earlier conception, a more basic, more fundamental conception of nama. So what you find in the suttas is both of these aspects are present. So this is why you can see different takes in different contexts of what nama can mean. It both contains like an older sense of meaning, but also a more both nama and rupa, and more an older, more if you like, more traditional meaning, where rupa means more or less like the body, in some kind of sense, but also a more sophisticated analytical meaning, where rupa is defined as the four elements and derived materiality. Yeah, so these two kind of meanings jostle a bit in the suttas. So, but the most basic way of understanding nama rupa, again, is to hark back to the mythic context. Nama rupa is exactly what Adam did in the Garden of Eden. Yeah, and Adam went round and gave names to all the animals. Yeah, so you have all of these shapes. Yeah, and he goes around and says, "I'm going to give you a name. You're an aardvark. You are a sheep. You are a kangaroo. You're a wombat." And so in each case, you've got an external thing, an external form, which is perceived. Yeah, so the person perceives these external forms as having a certain coherence, they hang together, and then you have a concept in your mind which corresponds with that external form. So you have like a cup, and when I see this, my mind in a sense isolates that cup as a thing which is separate from the world around it. It gives it a form, it gives it a shape, and that shape and that creation of that in my mind as a separate entity is facilitated by the mental process which gives this a name and makes it in a particular context. Now, of course, what's doing that is all of those mental factors which are mentioned, Vedana, Sanya, and so on. So that's then an analysis of that process. But the root meaning of what it's talking about is that how you make sense of things in the world by categorizing and classifying things according to the name of them. Now, again, to trace this back to earlier, more primitive conceptions, is that in earlier times there's no understanding of a distinction between the name of things and the things themselves. So again, this is the analytical sort of achievement which the Buddha is pointing to. In magical thinking, the name of something is the thing itself. It's actually the essence of something. And by knowing the name of something, you can exert control over and you can exert power over it. Yeah? And this is very, very characteristic of magical thinking. And the name of something is almost like a quasi-physical entity. Yeah? And you have these very very fascinating myths. Like in Egyptian myths, you have this story of Isis and Ra. And Isis wanted to get the true name of Ra, because of course very often in ancient societies or indigenous societies, people will hide their true name, so they have a name that they use externally, but that's not their actual real name. And if you know their real name, that's when you can do the magic to get them. So Isis wanted to know about what was Ra's real name. So when Ra's the sun god, it was Isis's father. Ra was walking in the evening through the garden, a bit like Jehovah did in the Garden of Eden, going for an evening stroll, and Isis put a snake down in his path, and the snake bit Ra on the foot. And he was, you know, in agony because of the poison and afraid he was going to die and so on. And Isis, of course, knew the antidote for the poison. So she said, well, I'd like to, you know, my dear father, I would like to give you the antidote. I'll free you from this suffering and give you life once more. But there's something I'm going to need if I'm going to do that. So she asked, he says, okay, I'll give you anything. She says, I need your true name. You know? And then it's like the way it's described, it's like the name passes over from Ra to Isis. Yeah, so it's almost like it crawls out of him and goes into Isis. So even in Pali you find this tendency. In the Theravada tradition you have this idea that Pali is the root language, which is the fundamental language of all existence. So that if a baby was to grow up without being taught any language, it would naturally speak Pali. Okay? So this is the idea that somehow language is part of the existence of things. Yeah? And that idea in the Theravadan scriptures being derived from the similar strains of thought in some of the Vedic Mimamsa traditions, which regard the Vedas as being in some ways kind of hard-wired into the fabric of reality. Of course, the normal Buddhist way of looking at these things is that the name of something is just a convention. It's just something that people adopt and has no intrinsic relationship with the object itself. So the idea of name and form is that it's very important, because those magical conceptions are not wrong, okay? But we would look at things in a different way. When you know the name of something, you do indeed have power over it. But you just don't have power over it in the same way that perhaps from a magical point of view that people thought that you did. And it's through that process of naming things, categorizing them, conceptualizing and so on, which leads to philosophy, to science, to technology, and all of those things. You know? And say in biology, that's a very large part of the process of biology, is simply to continue doing, in fact, what Adam started. Yeah. We were talking about that the other day, that still many of the great percentage of the organisms on Earth have not actually been named yet. Yeah, we haven't actually found them and classified them and named them. And through that process, we actually gain that knowledge which gives us power over the external world. It is, yeah. The rupa, obviously, is the same as the rupa kanda. And nama is, typically, nama is the... So if this is rupa, then nama is the vedana sanya sankhara. Very, very similar in meaning, not quite identical, but very similar. Yeah. Now, vijnana is not part of nama.
It's the upper nama.
It's not a part of Namaya. Not in the suttas. In the Abhidhamma, I'm not talking about Abhidhamma, I'm talking about the suttas, yeah? Means what?
Meaning.
The meaning of something, yeah. That's right, in an explanatory, yeah.
The rupa, I think, and the nama, the meaning of it.
Yeah.
So, that when you pick up a cup, so what is up there, what is the meaning up there to me? If I know that in the language, I call it in the name.
Huh.
And when I use it in Chinese language, and Ubeka, the name of it. So, yeah.
Has the meaning, yeah.
The meaning of that thing to your mind.
Yeah.
And the name is a language.
Yeah.
The language is a thing to deal with. So it is
not essential.
The meaning is more essential.
Yeah. The name, and in that case, the meaning is functional. Yeah. The meaning tells you it's something I can drink out of. Yeah.
And how to deal with it in your mind.
Yeah. Sankara is Chetana. Yeah. That's right,
And we've never probably even named those characteristics, but we immediately know there's a cup, I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously it's perception. And that is where, I mean, when you come to more complicated things, your perception will say, well, that is something, well, that's where it probably won't be.
Absolutely. Yeah. And these things are always more,
because
it's not a cup.
Because
if somebody offers me a cup of coffee, they say, do you want a cup or a mug?
That's always a problem trying to categorize anything.
Yeah.
They always fall into different.
It always.
But I'm just thinking in terms of actually fixing whatever category in mind and, you know, recognizing it.
Yeah.
You recognize it, and your recognition is based on many, many different learned.
This is sort of sanya,
And it's immediately it's there, but it's still a perception.
That's right, yeah.
There's another thing about name, because when you know a name for something, you see a lot more than if you don't you spot it.
Right.
If you know the name of it, whereas if you don't know the name, you just have a lot more.
Yeah.
The mind just can't move across.
Absolutely.
I think you probably can train. For me, because quite a few years ago, I realised there's no way I was ever going to know all the names of all the plants.
I had that feeling too.
So
after I learned grass and tree, I had that.
But
So it's not name and name and song. It is your meaning and the thing you think that we achieve and the meaning we make in our mind. Like the world, if you put 100 notes of gala and a human being can recognize it. But how about an animal? It has no meaning. So how we value it is it's a karma. I have to learn for yourself.
Yeah.
I'm not a good kid. So it's not me.
Yeah.
Actually, it is usually more conceptual, but it is more for their brain to work. More for their So your nama in each specific context, it means your meaning and not name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, like going into a lesson on emptiness.
Yeah.
And if you were to meditate on 12 links,
yeah.
And then do it good.
Typically to start with is you in meditation is you start with these ones here, which are the more sort of immediate and you know easiest to get hold of. Yeah, so just meditate on the sense experience and then on one's responses to that and how you get involved with that sense experience and so on, and then how you create a sense of self out of that and these kinds of things. Yeah.
Then when you go forwards or backwards.
you can do it either way. Yeah, you can do it either way. You know, you can from as it's depicted in the suttas, it branches off in a number of different ways. And in the Visuddhimagga also gives a number of different examples for how it can be contemplated. I think that's you know, practically speaking, that's the most important, is to get started on that, and from there, then contemplation can go in different directions. Yeah. But to some extent, I mean, obviously, if you want to understand it in terms of past lives and things like that, is until you have real insight into the Dhamma, that obviously remains to some extent theoretical, unless you have perception of past lives or whatever. One more.
The other link that I've had difficulty with is distance as a condition.
Uh-huh.
Definition of existence probably needs to be sort of clarified.
Essentially just that existence includes all the others. Yeah.
Because existence in this sense, I mean, the link between grasping and existence, is that going from one life to the next?
It's usually explained in that way. Actually, in the traditional explanation, bhava is explained as karma bhava, okay, which is the active side of existence, the side of existence that's actually, and so this is actually described as a synonym of sankhara. Bhava is described as an existence of sankhara. That's in the traditional Theravada interpretation. So that's obviously not incorrect, because obviously karma is a part of existence and it does perform that function, but that's not the whole meaning of it. The whole meaning is includes the entire round itself. Yeah.
So existence is something that is present in all of the things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The whole dependent origination is called the Bhava Chakra, the wheel of existence, the wheel of life. One way of looking at it, there's a very interesting piece on that in there's a book called by Peter Harvey called The Selfless Mind or something like that. It's about 15 years ago it came out. And he talks about that, and he related the idea of existence here to the Abhidhamma notion of Bhavanga. And in the idea of Bhavanga is literally the factor of existence, or the basic level of existence. And the idea of Bhavanga according to Abhidhamma is something like this, that when you take rebirth, that you take your karma sort of projects your consciousness onto a certain level, which is your bhava for that point, and the Bhavanga chitta is like the default setting of your mind in that particular state of existence. So that even though you might sort of develop more exalted mind states or more bad mind states, the tendency is that it tends to revolve around that kind of level, which they call Bhavanga. And so he associated that with the idea of bhava. that a state of existence or a state of bhava is in some sense a relatively stable, obviously not completely stable, but a relatively stable domain within which consciousness sort of persists for a certain period of time before then taking rebirth in another plane. Yeah. But again, you know, this is obviously is not a strictly linear process at that point. Also, you can think of it as emerging out of grasping, in the sense that I explained before, where grasping is associated with the development of intellectual and cognitive constructs, yeah, idea of a self or a view, these kinds of things, which tend to be quite long-lasting, don't they? Yeah, and you can often think that, you know, when you're getting older, that you can look back 20 years ago and say, well, actually, I had the same views about something as I do now. My thoughts have changed, my emotions have changed, all these things have changed, but my views, you know, of course they change sometimes, but they tend to remain, yeah, much more static. So through creating our ideas, and the grasping is like solidifying the contents of our mind, yeah? And so it's solidifying the contents of our mind in one particular way, which corresponds with some kind of sphere of existence, yeah? And that, of course, is always depicted very concretely in the Buddhist tales, especially if you look at something like the Vimana Vattu, where you know, when you do some kind of karma, yeah, in this life, is the blue side of existence, green side is the karma, same sankhara, then at that moment, then a celestial palace spontaneously appears, ready and waiting for you. Yeah? And so through that act, which you're doing here and now, you're actually preparing that kind of future existence. Your mind is being constructed in that kind of way, and that makes very vivid that kind of idea and that link between the karma and then formation of a relatively stable notion of existence, where you actually go into one particular domain for a period of time.
I think the instant is just grasp that it's not only just a value of perspective.
Right? Yeah.
Just what we're mentioning initially.
Yeah.
And no grasp and all like that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Just stop.
Yeah. Okay. So, thank you very much, everybody. And let's finish by paying respects.